on budget prioritization. This is Friday, the December the 14th. This is the final meeting of this special committee. I would just like to say that I think we're beginning to feel like we've been through some kind of battle or military thing together, and I do appreciate people hanging in here yesterday through the public testimony. That was a long day, and the emotional weight of the testimony that we received, I think, left us all very much drained by the end of the day. We have this morning from 8:30 to 10:30 legislator testimony. From 10:30 to noon, we have invited testimony. It's my intention to take a lunch break from 12 to 1, invited testimony from 1 to 4, and it's my intention to adjourn the committee at 4 o'clock this afternoon or sooner if we get through the testimony. We have a few announcements to begin with. The public record will remain open until 5 o'clock this afternoon, so all input that's received by the committee through the mail, through the email, through any other sources, telephone messages, etc., will be open until 5 o'clock p.m., and all of that accumulated material will become part of the public record. If things are received after the staffers have an opportunity to distribute it to the members of the committee, you'll receive that information subsequent to the adjournment of the committee. You have on your desk this morning a letter from Phil Lemon in response to committee questions. You have two packages of emails and one fax that were received by the committee, and these will be made part of the public record also. We will begin this morning with legislator testimony, and I would like to call Representative Donna Nelson.
Good morning, Representative.
Good morning, and today, nice to see all of my constituents here. I'm sure that y'all have been through an undaunting period of hearings, and I just thank you for your commitment to all of us and to my citizens of my district and our county and our state. And I'm glad that we've had this opportunity and others have had the opportunity to express their concerns to you. I thank you for this opportunity on behalf of New District 24, and at this time I would pay, I guess, my gratitude to Representative Lane Shetterly, who has stolen part of my county, but
I didn't want it.
I'm
happy to have it.
And yes, our day before yesterday, our I can't even remember the days. Day before yesterday, it was an unusual situation to testify with both Representative Shetterly and Representative Backlund, who took Newburgh from my district as we addressed the OTC. But I couldn't have had two individuals who are more competent to handle my county, and I'm honored to have them working on behalf of the Yamhillians. It's been an honor to serve with all of you in the legislature, and I thank you for your support. God blessed us, I felt, in the legislature this year, and we were able to bring home 99% of what our citizens needed and wanted, and that was done through a cooperative spirit, working together. And together now we can continue to find out what's right and do what's right so things turn out right. As our lives have been greatly changed by September 11th and the corresponding impacts to our economy, which was already facing recessionary trends, we now have to work hard, fairly and rightly, to protect our most vulnerable citizens, our seniors, our disabled, our veterans, and our children. those around us who've been battling hunger, homelessness, and hopelessness. And we certainly cannot dismiss the need for safety and security in this age of terrorism. I'm here today to relate to you a number of issues that were brought in our countywide town hall this week, which was attended by Representative Vic Backlund, Representative Ben Westland, and Senator Gary George. It was an incredible meeting, and citizens from various occupations and interests were there. So what I'm going to speak to you today really relates most of their sincere concerns. First of all, it is no secret that state government has grown in size some 70% over the past 6 years. Yet, Oregon rates in the lowest echelon in job growth, hunger, and employment, or unemployment. As long as we continue developing state budgets at the continuing or current service level, we will not have the detail with which we can fully evaluate performance. We need zero-based budgeting. It was a great disappointment to me when this bill passed House Committee and the full House and Senate Committee, yet was not heard in the Senate. If ever there was a time to account for dollars and cents from ground zero up, it was in the previous legislature and also now. The same situation was true with the need for the study of unfunded mandates passed on to our schools, costing some 10% of their budgets. Even Governor Kitzhaber agreed those mandates needed a look at, yet the bill was not heard. So today I'm here to speak to issues caused by our situations of not knowing fully the detail of our budgets, not knowing fully the impact of mandates of the laws and the administrative rules that we make that greatly impact the citizens of our state. First, I'd like to say that we need to employ the strategies and tactics of good business and common good sense family budgeting. Having been employed in major corporation for some 24 years and also been involved in farming, teaching, and in small business, I'm well aware of the different situations of resizing and restructuring. The first item that bothers us a lot in our county is why, when we cut budgets, the first thing we do is fire the clerks, fire the lowest echelon in salaries throughout our agencies. Reducing programs, likewise, those programs only costing few thousands of dollars, like family resource centers that are so critical to our children, our citizens in communities like Carlton or Yamhill Carlton in my county, my district, are reducing by $100,000 the support for our veterans. These few dollars really make good sense, C-E-N-T-S, and also S-E-N-S-E. We need to ask, whose money is it? We need to look at budgets from ground zero, not on the continuum of growing current service levels, and look at the budgets as far as impacts on our citizens. The two programs I just mentioned, veterans and family resource centers, for few dollars return maximum benefits. We need to ask those same questions about all phases of our budget. What programs give us the greatest return for the people's money? Is that a question we're asking? Secondly, we need to remember the purpose of government. we need to reiterate over and over again that our responsibility is, and our primary and only purpose is to do for our citizens what they can't do for themselves. At a time when public safety is a top priority, hunger and homelessness and emergency medical assistance and security are top priorities, this is a situation when we can't just say, let's have a blanket cut of 10% across all agencies. We have to ask what programs are critical to the well-being of our citizens, programs that they cannot provide for themselves, rather than absolute flat 10% cuts across all agencies, or 2% or even 10. The second point, we have concern for the enigma of PERS. Is there any private business in the state where individuals can retire at 50 and make more than they did while employed? Our citizens resent and reject this practice. Who will ever tell them that this sum is nearly a 30% figure? It is not right or fair for us in the legislature to allow such a practice to continue. Next, we need to look at the over 125 departments, boards, and commissions that are paid. We're maxed out. We need to back out of this maze of cost centers that are redundant with agency services, that are performing activities that the private sector is also involved in. Are we looking at the budget from that viewpoint? And under this subject, the last point from my citizens, the overcharging of fees for permits, licenses, and restrictive laws are preventing business development and growth. Let's eliminate those burdens and help jumpstart our economy. And thirdly, we do need zero-based budgeting and performance-rated auditing programs with citizen legislative participation. We need management by measurement through citizen legislative participation and oversight. That's good business. Even Peter Drucker, the great dean of management, would say the same thing. We need regular review of results, not just once a year or at the end of a session as we're looking at budgets. We need continuous review and accountability. We need criteria established and quarterly evaluations of how these agencies are meeting needs, or rid ourselves of those agencies, commissions, and boards. We need to inspect what we expect, and we need to know the total cost. We owe that to our citizens, our taxpayers, who are our bankers, whose hard-earned money pays our way. For example, it's my understanding, as we talk about our pride in passing a $5.2 billion education budget, that that's really $7.1. Did we look at the education budget in its totality? All cost centers need to be looked at in totality, not fragmented. Then we have other issues that were funded that were non-essential. And as you well heard me say on the floor, one of them happened to be OPB. When we're giving OPB $3 million and $2 million would cure the state of hunger, something is wrong with our practice. And then when we give them an additional $11 million of bonding, something is really wrong. Fourthly, we need to evaluate what jobs, what state functions could be performed by private enterprise more economically and efficiently. What has the Economic Development Division developed that has improved our state economy? We are accountable. That's their mission. That department, division needs renovation. We need to utilize our citizens, our businessmen, and focus on development. As I recall, there were only two issues during our legislature that provided additional job growth. One was cogeneration by burning straw. Now, not too many citizens could do that. The other was a proposal for a baseball team. One that would have provided additional jobs was elk farming, but we chose not to pass that development. We need diversity in our state. What we found was that we had overgrown in high tech. We need to go back to the basics and work to help our basic industries of farming, forestry, and fishing, and move the legal encumbrances, laws and restrictions on those industries. We need law to keep Oregon dollars in the state and incentives for business growth. And as we look at cutting the budget, we need to ask, what are we cutting that will further reduce growth rather than enhance it? Fifth, we need to use prudent business practices and policies in the management of cash. It's one thing to have a budget that we're worrying about, but in March, it's even more serious to know that we're in cash flow trouble. We cannot spend what we do not have and should not. New programs should be put on hold that are not essential critical services, as we previously mentioned. Budget and wage increases, likewise, should be frozen in those areas that are not critical for the well-being of our citizens. Further, we need incentives for departments, agencies to routinely work to reduce the burden on our taxpayers. In corporate life, that is a consistent management tool. And seven, we need administrative rulemaking, legislative oversight, because the costs of our laws grow greatly through the administrative ruling system. Administrative rules make programs more expensive. They become unfunded mandates. We need to freeze all mandates for which funding is not attached at onset. And in closing, we need to work not only as we worry about the budget, but to remove the barriers for free trade. We need to ask our federal government to assist us and assist us now. As we cut the budget, I think our most serious need in our state is for the 40% of our individuals who are hungry. This is a disgrace.
Thank you very much, Representative Nelson. I very much appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us.
Thank you, and I wish you all a Merry Christmas and a wonderful holiday.
Thank you. The chair next has the honor of welcoming the Minority Leader, Deborah Kefouri.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Deborah Kefouri, House Democratic Leader. First, I just want to thank you all for your hard work this week. I really understand that you've had a very difficult task in front of you, and I, for one, greatly appreciate that you've been here and put in this time to listen to all the testimony. On Tuesday, December 12th, Representatives Johnson, Hass, March, Rosenbaum, Monis Anderson, and myself presented testimony to the Senate Economic and Job Stimulus Committee. And out of respect for this committee, I wanted to come share the same information with you. However, in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through each of the proposals word by word. You have our written testimony in front of you. But I did want to outline quickly kind of the intent of our proposals. And the proposals that the House Democrats have submitted are designed to boost Oregon's sagging economy by helping businesses avoid further layoffs, helping communities by creating more jobs, and helping families who are struggling under unemployment. The House Democrats' job package contains 7 different ideas. The first is improving a little-known Oregon program that allows businesses to reduce their employees' hours and supplement part of the lost wages with unemployment insurance. We propose extending this program to keep more people in Oregon employed. The second proposal centers on the federal READ Act, which may soon bring anywhere from $30 to $115 million to Oregon to be used for unemployment purposes. If this money does become a reality, which looks like it may, we propose that it go towards putting a paycheck into the pockets of workers or extending health care coverage to the unemployed. I see from your agenda that later today you will be hearing from Freightliner, and that brings me to my third point. Oregon's Community Development Fund was recently used to help Freightliner keep 2,500 Oregonians employed at their Portland headquarters. We submit that this fund should be expanded or at least temporarily focused towards similar job retention efforts. We propose an addition, an investment of $1 to $5 million in the fund, but realizing that new money is scarce in these times, we also realize that focusing job retention as its main focus of the fund, at least temporarily, would be a great idea. Next, we propose that project readiness be a factor in deciding which capital projects are approved by the state. By identifying projects that can be delivered within a short timeline, we would have the necessary information to enable us to base our decisions on a project's immediate economic benefit. Such a standard was recently created by ODOT, and we could use similar language to ensure that projects that are ready to go are moved to the front of the line. We believe that economic benefit should also be a standard in expending in the expending of the public purpose fees that we will begin collecting in March. The fees will bring in approximately $45 million over the next year, and we want to ensure that the money is spent on energy conservation and renewable energy development, as was the intent of the legislation. But within that scope, we propose that it be spent on projects that provide an immediate economic benefit. We recommend that you look into where this money is going to be spent to give preference towards economic stimulation within the list of potential projects. Our sixth proposal is in line with efforts to attract a biomanufacturing facility to Oregon that would employ several hundred people to make biomedical products. This is a fast-growing industry, and we do not have a single such facility on the West Coast. We propose that the Economic and Community Development Department create a task force that would coordinate state efforts and explore building a contract biomanufacturing facility here in Oregon. Lastly, I would like to bring your attention to ways that local communities are assisting the state towards economic recovery. For example, Mount Hood Community College has developed a program called Operation Workforce Recovery. It's a special curriculum of short courses geared towards getting unemployed people into high-demand jobs. Innovative projects like these can have a major impact on our state's recovery, and we should make sure that these programs remain a priority throughout our budget rebalancing efforts. We'll close by stating that cutting budgets does not create a single job, and just as we have to deal with the budget shortfall, we should also be looking at our state's job shortfall. Appreciate your time, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Representative Kapoor. I appreciate you sharing that with us. Chair calls Representative Witt. Good morning, Representative.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. And as Representative Kefouri said, I also appreciate all the time that all of you are spending in this difficult process in determining how we as a legislature can best make decisions in terms of prioritizing our spending in this biennium to deal with the very severe budget shortfall that we have. What I wanted to do primarily this morning is to remind the committee of a bill I had earlier this session, which was H.J.R. 64, which basically gave a dual purpose to the Common School Fund, which has been a fund that is in our Constitution, and it relates back originally to lands that the federal government gave to the state of Oregon when it became a state back in 1859. That fund, as many of you probably know, now is at about $700 million. In my prepared statement, I said $800 million. It was $800 million about 6 or 9 months ago, but it has shrunk somewhat here in the last 6 to 9 months. But one of the things I think all of us in the legislature have grown to realize is how vulnerable we are to an economic downturn because we don't have a security fund. And there have been efforts over many years to try to establish a security or a stabilization fund in the state, which we have not been successful at accomplishing. However, I think if we're willing to look at the Common School Fund in a little bit different light, we realize that there is a potential stabilization fund that exists in Oregon, and it is the Common School Fund. It's a fund that has grown by more than $500 million in the last 10 years. That has come primarily from earnings from the investment of the fund throughout the 90s. The legislature, I believe, has it within its authority to determine that dollars from that fund can be used, particularly in times of an economic downturn, to shore up education, K-12 budgets. That is the only thing that it can be used for. But it does potentially bring some additional dollars into the process when you have the severe kind of economic conditions that we have today. And I think what it will do is, if we're willing to use it that way, is it will protect K-12 from significant budget cuts, while at the same time having other dollars in the budget available for other critical programs. I reviewed this proposal with Paul Warner in the last week and with Greg Chamoff at Legislative Council, and I do not believe that it requires a constitutional change to do what H.J.R. 64 was intended to do, but that it can be done by statute. And the way the H.J.R. 64 was written ultimately when it came to the floor is it allowed the legislature to, in essence, borrow money from monies from the fund when you have specific economic conditions, which clearly we would be in today, which in the original language, it was two quarters of declining payroll, non-farm payroll in the state of Oregon. And then it required the state to pay the fund back over 6 years once you had come out of the recessionary period. So if the recession lasted for 1 year, we would have 6 subsequent years to pay the fund back. That way we're not pulling money out of the fund without an obligation to return it. And by returning the money over 6 years as the economy has improved, it preserves the quality of the fund over the long term and also continues to make it available as a stabilization fund if you hit another or when you hit another recession at some point down the road. So I think this is actually a key component in terms of addressing the difficult issues that we have in front of us. We're all aware of the tobacco money and the Medicaid upper limit money and the ending balance and some of the other potential funds that are available. But I think through the use of the Common School Fund, potentially we could bring another $200 to $300 million to education funding in this biennium and protect education funding from cuts at this point in time and then pay that fund back later in the decade. Through that 6-year period. And I think it doesn't keep us from the requirement of some cuts, so obviously we're going to have to make some reductions. It helps cushion those reductions significantly. So I hope this committee would look favorably upon this idea, and I hope it stirs some debate. I know the Senate's had some discussion on this as well, and I really believe this might be part of the solution as we try to deal with this difficult problem over the next month or two. So thank you, Madam Chair. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Just one question.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Butler.
I believe the HGR that you had presented, Representative Witt, had the interest to be repaid as well. So the principal, the corpus that would be borrowed from the Common School Trust would be repaid plus interest. Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, actually not. We were just repaying the principal, but you know that's something that I'm certainly open to in terms of finding what's the most equitable solution. I think one of the things we want to do here is we want to be equitable and fair to children who are in school today and children who are in school in the future. And with the kind of budget challenge we have today, if we have to have significant cuts in education, that's obviously creates some challenges for children who are in school today. If it's the belief generally of the legislature, there should be some interest attached to it. I'm not opposed to that.
And follow up, Madam Chair, in the current $700 million balance, do we know how much of that actually comes from the corpus, the actual land grants under the original program, and how much is really accumulated interest, which should have been used or made available for education anyway?
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Butler, the great majority, probably 80% or more of the fund's balance today, is accumulated earnings, not the original value of the land that was granted by the federal government to the state. And in other words, those earnings, as they had accumulated in the past, could have been used and could have been designated to be used for K-12 education in those time periods. But now we have a large percentage of the fund, the great bulk of the fund, which is accumulated earnings off the original values of the land. And it seems to me that there shouldn't be any question but that those dollars should be available, and the legislature should have the ability to make a determination that those funds be used at a given point in time for education funding.
I appreciate that explanation of the corpus and the earnings on the corpus. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is not a question for Representative Witt, but a request that we ask, one, our council to prepare a opinion on the legality of this under the Constitution, and secondly, that we get an accounting of what is corpus and what is interest.
Madam Chair.
Representative Schutter.
Thank you. That was an issue of substantial debate in the Revenue Committee as we dealt with this last session. I've already asked Council to revisit that, and part of the constitutional analysis will directly involve the determination of what is corpus and what is principal. So those two questions are very much intertwined, and I'm hoping to get an opinion on that shortly.
Representative Canoe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Witt, it's an interesting idea. The question I have, and it's based on assumptions, and maybe you can tell me if my assumptions are correct, but if the fund was $800 million and it's down to $700 million, I'm going to assume that through bad investments or the downturn in the stock market that we lost a significant amount of money. So if, I guess, the stock market continued to go down, would it then be logical to assume that if we actually took part of that money out of investment and used it and paid it back, that ultimately we could be better off because we would continue not to lose money in the market? Does that logic hold up, or do you?
Madam Chair, Representative Finot, that certainly would have been true for the last year. I certainly hope that's not true for the next 6 years. Actually, the fund's doing a lot better than my investment fund. So, but nonetheless, I mean, that's kind of interesting. But, you know, I think there's a reasonable argument that there should be some kind of a reasonable guaranteed interest on the borrowings. But I don't see that as the stumbling block. I think if there's a challenge here, it's getting unanimity that this is a reasoned and a responsible and a legal approach to try to address the budget shortfall that we have.
Representative Bates.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. And I'd like to follow up on the question to posed to you by good Representative Wright. This is sort of a minimal loss of revenue in the last year, and I'd like to know who did the investments, because I had to talk about some personal stuff too, okay? But having said that, I guess what you're really asking us to do, and it's something that I'm not necessarily opposed to, actually I think it has some real merit, is to think of this really not as a funding source that we've always used for schools by taking a certain amount of interest off, but by in fact a rainy day fund that we've actually inadvertently created, not purposely, but inadvertently created in the last 10 years during the great years of the Oregon economy. And my question is, how much money have we been pulling from that in the last 10 years as far as interest each year, and why did we decide not to pull more money out? I mean, obviously, somebody was thinking that we didn't want to do that. They wanted the fund to grow, and potentially looking at it as something to be a large funding source in the future for our schools, or was it because they were thinking it was a rainy day fund also?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, in fact, I have a distribution chart here that I'll be happy to get you a copy of that Paul Warner gave to me. It goes back to 1982, and it shows the amount, the distributions to schools from the Common School Fund. It's interesting, in the 90s, when the fund was really growing rapidly, many biennium, we were only taking $15 to $20 million from the fund. even though the earnings were substantially more than that. The legislature, I don't think, was really making this determination, though. I think it was being done by the land board, was actually determining how much of this is going into K-12 funding in any given biennium. I think the legislature has the right to make that determination with the governor's signature as part of legislation and appropriation. However, it is true that throughout the 90s, relatively little money was being pulled out of the earnings at the time, and because of that, we have this massive amount of accumulated earnings. On your other point, I do think we have created a school stabilization fund through the Common School Fund, if we're willing to use it that way. And we did it because the accumulated earnings have been so much greater than what was used from the fund, particularly in the 90s when the fund grew so robustly.
Follow-up question?
Follow-up?
There must be some oversight somewhere about how that money is to be used, what percentage is to be pulled off every year. Either the legislature has that authority or the governor does. It sounds like this group who runs the fund has made their own decisions on it. And that's something that this might be a time to review and look at also, that certain amounts should be retained at all times and certain amounts shouldn't be, the fund be continued to grow, or that we do designate it as a rainy day fund for the state, because obviously you can fund K-12 through it, and that back funds the rest of the state state budget also.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Bates, to comment on that, I think it's prudent that the fund was allowed to grow so much throughout the 90s. And
I agree.
In my proposal on HJR 64, I specifically, the language of HJR 64 specifically stated that you could pull these additional dollars only when you had certain economic conditions in place, and then the requirement to pay it back. Because I don't think we want this to be as a slush fund that the legislature can get its hands on whenever it wants, irrespective of economic conditions. And I think the requirement of paying the dollars back, which we worked out on Revenue Committee as we worked on this bill, I think was a good requirement, because there should be some fiscal discipline in terms of how this fund would be approached, so that it is preserved as a stabilization fund for the long term. The beauty of this at this point in time, I think, is that our schools today, which could be severely impacted with the kind of economy we have today, could be given some significant protection if we use this fund in a responsible way, both now and for the long term.
If I might interject, if my memory serves me correctly, the revenue folks have a fairly comprehensive briefing paper prepared on this subject, and so if anyone is listening back in that corner of the building, and they could make copies of that available to the committee, I think that would be a valuable thing to add to the process. My recollection also is that there is a very proscribed formula for the distribution of the funds, and I think that if we can get that information, we'll all benefit from it. The Representative Shetterly,
thank you.
Wish to comment?
Well, we had a lot of fun with this in the Revenue Committee during the last session, and I don't remember, was that co-sponsored by all the members of the committee?
It was,
yeah. So had a lot of bipartisan support during the session. I know one of the things that, apart from the constitutional issues that we just need to know the answers to, one of the concerns that I think prudent legislators have about taking money out of the Common School Fund is, well, we deplete that, how do we know where we're going to put that money back in? Of course, that fact is true when you're talking about any rainy day fund that you've created. Once you've created a rainy day fund, whenever you take that out, you're going to have to put that money back in, or you have just violated the long-term purpose of it. That's right. So that's not an issue that I think should stop us particularly looking at this as the source. I think the thing that we appreciated in the Revenue Committee about the Common School Fund was that it avoided the what has become the stumbling block to a rainy day fund, and that is how you create one. Whether you take 2% out of the out of appropriations every biennium so that you're not funding other programs and services that badly need it, or whether you're keeping the kicker, or whether you're creating some new tax source, all those discussions go by the way because that money is actually there and available. And then it shifts the discussion to, well, for what purposes should we use it? That's prescribed by the Constitution, education, and then, of course, the obligation to reimburse it, and that would be there in any event, no matter what source we were using
for rainy day funding. Here comes Paul Warner with the briefing paper. See, I wanted to keep vamping until the second verse started.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hass has requested this.
Thanks. I just wanted to say I was not a co-sponsor of that, and I was on the Revenue Committee.
Oh, okay.
My issues.
He was on that day.
I was there. There were some very serious legal issues raised by the Council to the Lands Division over the Admissions Act, and beyond that, I think there's some very prudent questions about, you know, when do you raid principal as opposed to just using the interest, mm-hmm. and that school fund has been very good for Oregon schools for many, many years, since, well, 1841 and back to statehood. And, you know, to raid the schools fund to help schools, in my opinion, was just sort of an easy way to do something that we should have been doing during the 90s, which was to establish and fund a rainy day fund. And so I was just opposing just doing the easy way out when this came up for discussion in the Revenue Committee.
Thank you. I will exercise the chair's prerogative and bring the revenue folks forward to answer the committee's questions on the fund. Representative Witt, you're welcome to stay and take part in the discussion if you wish.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Warner, can you give us the 45-second overview here of the...
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to. I'm Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Officer. Representative Witt had mentioned H.J.R. 64, and we did have quite a lengthy discussion during the session about the Common School Fund. Right now, it is treated as a local revenue source for the purposes of the school distribution formula. The fund grew from about $200 million at the beginning of the 90s to around $700 million today. The reason for that growth was a decision on the part of the voters to allow the Treasury to invest the fund's monies into equities. And of course, the timing on that was almost ideal because that was when the stock market took off. So the fund grew very rapidly. The fund itself, the distributions of the fund, are determined by the State Land Board, who consists of the Governor, the Secretary of State, and the Treasurer. So they make the ultimate decision on those distributions. There was a decision in 1999 to increase the distribution because the returns had been very high. On this current biennium, that distribution has been reduced significantly because the fund, as Representative Witt pointed out, has actually shrunk in value over the last year. The land board has determined a funding approach where they'll have a minimum distribution of 2% of the value of the fund, and then they stair-step that up if the returns on the fund are greater. If it's greater than 2%, then a certain amount goes into building the principal, and then once it gets above 5%, then they can distribute more than the 2% out to schools. So over the current biennium, the estimate is $31 million for the distribution that would go through the formula.
Questions by the committee members? Representative Butler.
Thank you. Paul, I'm just referring to the graph which Representative Witt had taken us to briefly that we now have a copy of in our possession. Notice a rather substantial portion of that is cross-hatched as principal. I'm wondering if on an annual basis or biannually, as the case may be, if the amounts that are not converted or not diverted or actually utilized within the Common School Fund and moved to the Common School Fund, do those then become corpus? Is that what that's being treated as? And the excesses of the amounts that you're talking about, the 5% shifts and so forth.
Representative Butler, the 2% minimum distribution is a relatively recent policy decision on the part of the board. But basically that's correct. And anything that is not distributed goes into the principal and grows the fund.
Okay.
And there was a conscious effort made, really going back to the early 90s to build the principal, of the fund.
And Chair, follow up. I just want to make certain that, there's a very definite delineation between actual corpus and additions to corpus as a result of strictly earnings and additions to corpus under the original constitutional setup of the Common School Trust Fund. I'm not asking you for a legal opinion, but I know from a strictly accounting sense, we don't add previous unused earnings to corpus without attaching a special tag to those earnings that have been converted to corpus, as opposed to public lands or those properties which were unclaimed or earnings, I guess, or actual distribution. Sales of public lands is one of the corpus uses of it. Can we identify those, in your opinion?
Representative Butler, Madam Chair, we have discussed that and begun looking at that issue. The original sale of lands, of course, go back to the time of admissions, and there's quite a colorful history on the sale of some of those lands. We have about a quarter of them left now, so three quarters of them were sold. Most of that occurred around the turn of the last century, so you go way back. And if you interpret the language in the Admissions Act of proceeds, then you could look back at the sales. Of course, we're talking about 100 years ago, but you look back what the sales prices were and then make some estimate from that. So that portion is probably relatively small in value, just because the price level was so much lower at that time and land was so much lower priced. Most, of course, all of the revenue is, as you can see from that chart, flowing into the fund now, comes from the earnings off that land, primarily from forestry.
But it's been cross-hatched as principal at this point, when in fact it would be a quasi-principal, that is, unused earnings that are diverted to principal.
Exactly. That's correct.
Representative March.
Thank you. Mr. Warner, I presume that our $700 million and the decrease represents a paper loss, in that if we actually cashed out some of that money, we would have an actual realized loss. Right now, it's just an equities sort of picture loss.
Representative Marks, that's correct. The fund itself, and I'm not sure, you can see the distribution of the fund is a portion of it that is in equities.
Right, it's about...
And so that will be managed. It's about 68% in equities. So that's the value of the fund at a point in time, the point in time being this past Halloween. So at that point in time, that was the value. So most of those would probably be paper losses as a result of declining value over the past year.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul, looking at the distribution graph, it looks like there was a dramatic jump in 2000 and 2001, and we put as much as $40 million in 2001 from the fund into school funding. Does it take, and that was what you described as the period where the legislature made a decision that we could use more of the fund in the 99 session? Does it take a statutory change to do that, or was that just a budgeting decision that was concurred in by those that are on the State Lands Board?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, that decision was made by the State Land Board. It was an issue that received considerable attention in the 99 session from the legislature, but the State Land Board had the ultimate decision on how much to distribute, and then that became part of the overall budget discussion for the school budget, and then it was really based on the fact that the fund had grown much faster than anticipated because of the stock market performance in those prior 2 years. So that was the decision. And then, of course, the reverse decision is assumed for the next 2 years because the fund has been shrinking in value.
A follow-up, Madam Chair. Yes. So then would the statutory change that Representative Wood is proposing would set some guidelines for when you would dip into the corpus of this fund? Would it also take away, I mean, is there a constitutional authority that's invested in the lands board to dispose of those funds? Cannot take away?
Representative Rosenbaum, I would like to defer that to council. My understanding is it is a statutory, the duties are determined statutorily.
So
the duties of the land board. But
that
I'd like to defer to council. Mm-hmm. Well, but
Representative Canoe, I'm sorry, did you finish?
Well, I think I got a direction for where to go with the question.
Okay. Representative Canoe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul, I'm unclear here. How much of the fund is convertible securities? I know some of it's obviously property that you're not going to be able to sell, but actually convertible with cash.
Madam Chair, Representative Canole, the only thing I know on the portfolio are the general percentages you see there, 68% equity, so I assume those are common stock that can be probably index-type funds.
Okay.
But I don't know that, and we can certainly get that information. The Treasury manages that account.
And just to clarify, Madam Chair, Representative Witt, your idea is to sell the securities and borrow that money from the fund, or to essentially use those securities as collateral and borrow that?
Madam Chair, Representative Knope, presumably it could be done either way. But I imagine what you would do is make liquid some of the assets in the fund, and that's what you would borrow, because ultimately what you want is cash.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. Not to provide the answer, because this gets more complex as you peel away the layers of the onion, but just for the committee's information, Article 8, Section 4 of the Constitution that deals with the Common School Fund says that provision shall be made by law for the distribution of the income of the Common School Fund. I think that's the word the council is going in the direction that it's a legislative determination. And then where it says distribution of the income, this gets back to Representative Butler's question, is that current income or is that accumulated income? Does accumulated income revert to principal if it's not distributed? Clearly that's not addressed in the Constitution, so that's what they're struggling with. I think one of the questions, too, is how much of this is income and available for distribution. It is clear, though, that the purpose is limited to that of schools. But those are some of the legislative language. But it does say that the provision shall be made by law for the distribution.
The committee members, we need to move along so that we can stay within the framework of our original schedule. But Representative Witt, you have engendered a very interesting and I think put a very concept that is worth further work on the table, and I very much appreciate that. And I appreciate the gentleman from the Revenue Office joining us. Thank you.
Nearby, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Listeners. I will call next Representative Jeff Krupp. And also for the record, we have received a communication from the Department of State Police that answers some of the questions that were raised in their presentation, and that's been made available to the committee and is part of the permanent record. Good morning, Representative Krupp.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It is good to see you all, although I wish it were under different circumstances, as I'm sure you do too. I do appreciate, as has been already denoted by other members testifying, the hard work you've done in sitting here for a number of days and listening to a great deal of angst, clearly, from a lot of individuals and agencies as to how the potential issue that's before us is going to affect them. I have some thoughts on that, and that's why I'm here to share them with you today. In my view, we've spent too much. We've had a marvelous economy. We've had a great inflow into the state coffers, the state treasury, and we've spent it all. And that's why we're faced with the issue that we are today. If you look at the general fund growth from 1972 to 1997, a 25-year time period, our general fund growth has grown 1,031%. 1,031%. While inflation and population growth combined in that time was less than half of that. In the last two sessions that I've been here, myself included at times, has voted for budgets that have grown our general fund well over 30%. This is clearly unsustainable, as we have seen. And it's not an issue that we are alone in facing. Some of us were back at NCSL in Washington, D.C. Just recently, and it is an issue that is certainly affecting all states, some worse than others. Those states who have poorer economies, and Oregon's is certainly at the bottom right now in America, are facing a bit of a worse problem. We have to tighten our belt. I think we all recognize that. just as we do in our personal lives when we have issues that arise such as this, and just as we do in our businesses. I will tell you, on my farm, this has not been a good year, sadly. And I've had to tighten my belt even further than what I did last year. That hurts. It puts me behind in some of the areas that I felt were important for me to move in the future to maintain a viable farm. I'm not going to be able to do that. But I've had to bite the bullet, and I've done it. And let's discuss this issue of budget rebalancing from the perspective of, are we really cutting, or are we simply reducing an increase? Because the levels that I have seen in most agencies are not true cuts. They're rather a reduction in an increase that we granted them in this last session. So let's keep that in mind. Because a cut to me is when I have to cut employees. In other words, I spend less on my farm in a particular area than I did 2 years ago or last year. That's a cut. That's not what we're doing here, generally speaking, although we probably will end up in some areas. I would urge you to focus on the core mission of state government. What is the core mission of state government? And while that is somewhat debatable, I would encourage you to look at the Constitution in regards to certain issues. And I think paramount amongst them is the public's well-being and safety, so that we can have a peaceful and orderly society. How do we achieve that? Well, obviously, you have to have a court system that is able to function. You have to have a state police. You have to have a National Guard that is able to function and respond when necessary, irrespective of the economic times we're in. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't have adjustments there. You certainly shall. But if you cannot ensure the domestic peace and tranquility, you cannot have a strong economy. Therefore, you do not have tax revenues to spend on many of the issues that we as legislators have deemed important. So you have to focus on the core mission of government first. And then I think you have to go down the line and look at and examine each program for its worth. It's something that I have long felt we do not do a good job of here. And I would hope that in the coming years we were able to address that in our budgetary discussions during normal session. Now, what we're facing is not something that, again, as I've stated, is unique. All states are facing revenue shortfalls, and they're dealing with it in different ways. But I would call to your attention, we just received a copy of Governing Magazine, and I think probably all of you may have received a copy of that. And in there is a marvelous article about Governor John Engler from Michigan. It's often been referred to the Michigan miracle. Since he took office, when he took office, rather, Michigan was $1.84 billion in debt. Some years later, after 31 tax cuts, they now have $1 billion in their rainy day fund. They have totally eliminated capital gains tax and the estate tax in Michigan. Michigan consistently, year after year, and in the last 2 years specifically, has led the nation in manufacturing job creation. They have done a marvelous job. If they can do it, I believe we can do it. And that brings me to my next point about economic stimulus. No discussion about this budget issue can be complete unless we talk about economic stimulus. I very much appreciate the minority leader's point of view that we must have job creation. It's not just about rebalancing our budget and reducing our rate of increase. It's about job creation also, because that's what will sustain us for many years to come. That is what has sustained us for the last 10 years or so. So in that regard, you have to consider possibilities. How do you craft a policy direction here that not only deals with rebalancing, but also encourages business investment and capital formation? And I would encourage you strongly to look at the Michigan example, because I think there is a working example that's a framework that is appropriate for us to consider. I think it's clear that we're going to have to try to prioritize in a manner that causes the least amount of pain. And I mean that sincerely, in that some of the issues that you're going to have to make decisions on and that we will ultimately end up voting on in special session are going to be painful. You've been sitting here for a number of days, and you've heard the potential pain that can be out there. That is not lost on me. I fought very hard for a project or for a particular issue called Project Independence. It's very dear to my heart. It will probably have to suffer pain also. These are not going to be easy decisions for any of us to make. I would ask that you start in that pain with the legislature's budget first. I think we have to lead by example. I think it is important that we rescind the pay increases that are going to be granted to us. I think that many of the expansions in our budgets needs to be rescinded. I think those pay increases need to be rescinded from the all administrative agencies, executive branch. I think we need to put a hiring freeze until this problem is worked out. I think that's clear. I think that we need to look at stopping new programs that we granted through legislation and in budgetary issues in this last session. I don't think we can afford them. I think we need to look at, if you're not going to look at across-the-board cuts, and you, of course, have to prioritize by looking at the functions of the core mission of government first, and then looking at extraneous programs for what they're really worth, and can we afford them? Are they achieving the goals that we desired when we funded and implemented those programs, even perhaps many years ago? Those, I think, are important issues, because you see, those are issues that we in private enterprise have to deal with when we're faced with circumstances as we are today in our economy. We are a generous society. That's a good thing. There's a marvelous principle based on, it's a French principle. It's called noblesse oblige. And it stands for nobility obligates. And we are a noble people. We are a prosperous people. And we make decisions to try and bless our fellow citizens in many ways. But when times are tough, then we simply have to reduce those issues, reduce those programs, so that we can balance our budget. Be careful with using the ending balance, because we know that we already have a hole in our upcoming budget in the 03-05. I think Representative Witt's idea is very intriguing. I think we should look at it carefully and examine it. I would encourage you that if we move forward in any policy direction of that type, that we should certainly include repayment of interest along with principal in that regard. I think that's good business. So with that, I thank you for your diligence, and I mean that. I know this has not been easy for you, and I appreciate your time that you've put in here. And I look forward to working with you to resolve our issues. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Krupp. Chair calls Representative Judy Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I come to you today with an idea, a plan, a different way to look at our K-12 budget. I recently requested from the Department of Education to calculate cost savings as a reduction in school days. According to the department, savings would be about $14 million a day for the next school year. Staff department used cost information from the Database Initiative Project, as well as the quality education model for these projections. The department, for the most part, made pro rata reductions to come up with estimated savings. It concentrated on employee salaries and benefits, since these are the largest expenditure groups and in most cases directly affected by a reduction in the number of the school days. Employee salaries includes those for teachers, administrators, and classified employees. If, for instance, 5 contract days were taken, that would be a savings of $70 million. The decrease comes without a reduction in educational student days. For instance, at the Mooloolah River School District, there are 190 contract days, but only 172 educational student days. I will point out that one thing to keep in mind with this plan is that districts would have to negotiate for a reduction in the number of days with certain employee groups. The number of days in school is not set by statute, but exists in administrative rule within the Department of Education. I was specifically interested in seeing the savings in transportation, such as fuel and utilities, such as heating and electricity. However, bus fuel is included in an account entitled Student Transportation Services, and building and heating and electricity costs are in an account entitled Property Services. Property services expenditures include not only heating and electricity, but cleaning and garbage maintenance and other property-related expenditures. Thus, bus fuel and heating and electric costs could not be easily isolated, and obtaining these costs would mean surveying all 198 school districts. That would take a lot of time for us to do, not enough time to bring back to this committee. Instead, the department did pro-rata reductions on all costs recorded in these accounts. Similar adjustments were made to other accounts depending on whether the costs are incurred only during a school year or a year-round school. And you can see on the back couple of pages I have for you from the Department of Education spreadsheet. And the reason why I come up with this plan is because what happens to typically school districts in tight budgetary times will eliminate the library program and the purchase of books, the music program, the physical education program, counseling, and so forth. My plan would keep the education system whole. So when we return to better financial times, and we will, we can easily go back to the number of school days we originally had. One of the trade-offs of the plan, however, is to reduce the workload for our teachers. Based on many conversations and interviews I've had in the last several months, I'm going to put out ideas from the teachers, the principals, and the superintendents that they have brought to me. I would suggest eliminating student portfolios as a time cost measure. I would also eliminate the CAM, the Certificate of Initial Mastery at the high school level. I would lighten the burden of testing to two types instead of four, and you heard Superintendent Bunn testify to that earlier this week. And I would also streamline the grant application to process for school districts. My school district in Wallala will no longer be applying to grants for the Department of Education because it costs them too much to apply for grants. They have hired one person solely to apply for grants, as it's not something that can be done on a part-time basis. I think the Department of Education also needs to employ a rebalance every 6 months, just like the Department of Human Services. This would lessen the likelihood of DOE coming to the legislature every interim to ask for more money. I've asked some teachers in my district the following question. Would you give up 5 days of your pay to make sure we have music and library? And their answer is a resounding yes, because you have to remember when those students are in music class and library class, that is classroom time for teachers to prepare and work. And that's one of the big issues with teachers, is they don't have enough time to do the job. Many times, the first reaction to my idea is, well, why not just go to a four-day week? The only problem with a four-day week is salaries are not reduced because the length of the day is extended to account for the shortfall. And you have to remember, all salaries at the K-12 level account for 80% of the school budget. I also think quality of education is severely affected at the elementary level because it means longer days for our students. And I think it's too hard for the younger grades. I also think this plan is not going to work unless it is mandated by the Department of Education. If school districts are left to their own devices to tinker and to answer to this special interest group or that, the savings will not be fully realized. These are just a few of the ideas I've brought you today, and I can tell by the looks on some of your faces, it is fingernails on a chalkboard. However, I do believe it's serious time that we take a very hard look at what our educational system is doing in this state and admit and own up to the fact that these programs are not working at the DOE level, then DOE needs to take a look and possibly don't do them or revise them. Questions?
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Mark.
I just had one, Tootie, on page 3, you talk about eliminating the certificate of initial mastery, but then you've got...
Advanced mastery is what I meant to say, Steve.
Oh, okay. That's why I wanted to clarify that. Yeah. So it's advanced.
Well, the reason for that, and I think, and I'm assuming all of you know why, it's not implemented yet. It's been 10 years in the making, and we still haven't figured out how to implement it. It's designed, as I understand it, for admission requirements for students to go to college. However, after talking to college presidents and so forth, they tend to look at grade point averages mostly and SAT scores.
Thanks.
Further comments or questions? Thank you, Representative Smith. The numbers that you've given to us are very interesting numbers.
I think they may be a little on the conservative side since we were not accurately able to calculate fuel costs or heating costs. Keep that in mind.
Chair calls Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm so glad Representative Smith heard my fingernails there. Those were mine. First, I'd like to take just a few seconds to thank you, and I know many people have thanked you individually and privately for the outstanding way that you have conducted this committee, and I think all of us really do appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to talk about a couple things in general since we're dealing with the total budget, and then a little about children, and you would all be disappointed if I didn't talk about education. What else could I talk about, since it happens to be something that I have spent 40 years of my life working with? And I guess in general, and you're all aware of this, we're certainly dealing with a mosaic that we're painting for the future of Oregon. And I think as we're doing that, we're all aware of the fact that it's a house of cards, or it's building a wide bridge to go across to the future. And I think within that, we have to be very careful, and I really appreciate Representative Butler and Winters and several others pointing out the fact that when we take one of these cards out, we often move things to another area and it doesn't work, and we end up doing the penny wise, pound foolish, the whole piece there. And I think we need to keep that in mind in every single way. And I think with children in particular, that's true because of the interrelationship between education, the juvenile justice system, the health system. All of those are so critical to everything that we do. Talking about children's needs, and we all know those ranging from prenatal to the various other areas up to and including young adults who are just beginning their adulthood in a variety of ways. The services for these needs come from a variety of sources, too. They come at the national level. They come at the state level, they come at the community level, and certainly they come at the family level, where healthy homes are very, very important to everything. I want to talk now about education. We know what works in education. We keep trying to find new things. We keep trying to find better ways to do things, which I don't object to. We know that early intervention works. We know that early intervention prevents incarceration and long-term remediation in many, many ways. We also know that teaching kids to read is a critical component. We know the statistics of kids who don't read, who are in our prisons, who are not making it in our world. We know that special education kids have special needs, and we've heard data since we were here at the percentage of incarcerated young people who don't read and who have special ed concerns. Again, I'm getting back to prevention rather than incarceration and remediation. We heard someone testify, and I have to take a point of almost contradiction here, that in checking around, the schools provided the place.